Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. And today we listen to the third and final episode of our conversation with Valerie Hemingway, author of Running with the Bulls, My Time with the Hemingway Family. Valerie, thanks again for joining us. It's been stated that Hemingway has now become the number one written author, now surpassing Shakespeare. More people write about Hemingway than anybody has ever written about any other author. I think we see this stuff come out all the time, over and over again. There's always new books coming out, but it's always great to have this firsthand information. Where were you in your life at physically? Actually, where were you at? And then, what were you doing when you heard that Hemingway had passed?
Yeah, well, I was in New York, and I was working for Newsweek magazine, which was exactly, you know, what I wanted to be doing with my life. And Mary called me up. It was the 2nd of July. It was a long weekend, the July 4th weekend. And I was staying with my cousins, Dr. Larry and his wife, Helen Dunn, in Great Neck on Long Island. And Mary said, you know, she told me that Ernest had... Well, at that time, in her mind, she couldn't accept that he'd killed himself, and she'd said there was an accident and he had died cleaning the gun. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, could I free myself and come out to the funeral? And when I asked Newsweek, of course, they were thrilled. They said, of course, you know, you must go, and of course, you must dispatch.
Scoop the story.
You return, you know, all the information to us. But, you know, I said, I absolutely can't do that. I can only go out as private, you know, as a friend. And because I knew that, I didn't know the full extent of it, but I knew that I wasn't going to go out for Newsweek, you know, because I got a private invitation to there. When I got there, Mary was very... She had realized that I was working for Newsweek, and as she had been a journalist, worked for Time for many years, and worked for Chicago Daily News, worked for the Daily Express and Sunday Express in London, you know, and she was an avid, you know, Mary knew how to get the story, and she was the first woman to get a cover story on Time magazine, which was a huge coup for her and for womanhood, but I had no intention of doing that, and I couldn't believe that she just refused to see me the whole time that I was there. And you know, and I was thinking, oh, you know, now in a way I wish I told, well, of course I didn't, but I wish I'd told Newsweek I would do it, because you know, I got damned on both sides, for them for not doing it and for Mary for what she thought I was going to do. And but during those 5 days that I was there, two or three of Ernest's sisters were there, his brother Lester was there, the three sons were there, but the youngest son Gregory was in disgrace with Mary, and I think he had several run-ins with his father, and so Mary also distrusted him. So the two of us were excluded from all the gatherings, because it was just a private funeral. It wasn't open to the public. It was by invitation only, and it was, you know, just a few select people. And Greg and I spent 5 days together, and we became great friends. I had, you know, I'd heard that... Well, the thing that Ernest had said to me was, oh, he said, I had three sons. He said, Gigi was my best son, and then he turned bad. And that was all he ever said. And whenever Greg's name came up, there was complete silence, because it wasn't allowed to be said in the house. So I had no idea. And then when I met this person who was charming and interesting and so on, I just couldn't even imagine, you know, why things didn't go well between him and Mary and Ernest. So anyway, it was during the year after Mary, a week after I went back to Newsweek, Mary called me up and she said, could I come down to Cuba with her? she'd got permission from the US government. Well, I was an Irish citizen. I didn't need any permission to go there. And I'd been the last person who was there, and I spoke Spanish, and I was the ideal companion to go with her to see if she could take all his papers out and whatever else, her own personal papers and her own personal possessions. And so I said, yes, I would. I mean, it just seemed like the only decent thing to do. And so I went down with Mary, and we did, and that's when we met Castro. Ernest only met Castro for about 10 minutes when he presented. It was a public event. He presented him with the trophy when Castro won the Hemingway Marlin fishing tournament in 1960. And at that point, it was the only time they ever spoke to each other. And Ernest congratulated him on the fishing. And Castro said how he'd always been an admirer and had read many of Hemingway's books. And in fact, he had taken For Whom the Bell Tolls with him to the Sierras and had used it as a handbook, as a guerrilla operational handbook. And it had helped him, he felt, in winning, in being the victor in the revolution. So Ernest was very pleased about that. But that was the only time they ever encountered each other, and it was in the midst of a huge crowd of people and photographers and so on. Anyway, when Mary and I went there was a big bowl of flowers and fruits, tropical fruits there from Castro to Mary with a sympathy note and saying, I will come, if you need anything, I will come to the house and see you. And Mary, you know, she was asked to call up and name the time and date, and she did. And we did spend one long evening with Castro, and he was very helpful, very charming. And, you know, he was 33, and I he seemed like a regular person. And actually Mary was pretty impressed too, because he just had an ease of being with people and charming and not pushing himself in any way. And especially in the situation with, when he was talking to the grieving widow. But before we left, or about the time we left Cuba, Mary asked me if I would come out to Ketchum and spend a couple of months there, and just she wasn't ready to be on her own. So I said yes. Well, then that turned into 4 months, and during that time all sorts of people came out to see her. Well, Alfred Rice, her lawyer, and that, but Charlie Scribner came out, the third, I think it was, whoever was the head of the company at that time. And then they were talking, and Scribner offered an office at the building. They had a wonderful building at 48th and 5th on Fifth Avenue, where they had their publishing offices, and downstairs they had the most marvelous bookstore that Ernest used to get a lot of books from. And upstairs there were some extra rooms in that, and he offered a room for Mary to put her things, all Ernest's papers in. And then that while he was there, Mary offered me the job to go through the papers, which took me about 4 years. I mean, I did it one full year full time, and then I did for the next 3.5 years, I did it part time. So I went through all of those papers, everything that he had written and that he'd collected from his childhood. And so this is my third time now going, well, through the letters of the period that he dictated to me at the time I was there. And then I went over them. I had to, well, what Mary had specifically asked me to do was she had hired Carlos Baker. Well, that was at Ernest's request. He was appointed the official biographer. Carlos Baker was a professor at Princeton University. And then Mary asked me to go carefully through all the papers, and if there were things in it, and she discussed the type of thing that a family didn't want in a official biography, that I was to pull those things out, and so that Baker didn't see them. So that was my mission, and so I went through all his, well, mostly, you know, not those first couple of years, it was letters and notes and things like that. Later it was the manuscripts and the other things that, you know, that would be open to Baker anyway, or whatever whatever he needed for as material for the biography. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, I was just so incredibly lucky that all of these opportunities opened for me. And I would say at that time, I knew more about Hemingway than anyone in the entire world. You know,
I would have to say that still holds true.
Collection. Yeah. Before. But Mary had, you know, I mean, not, there was no contract, but it was understood that I was not going to let any journalists or whatever biographers or other biographers know what was in there. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I was privy to a lot of very private material. So
now, it was tricky physically getting these out of Cuba, though. That's a story in and of itself, too.
That's another story, because there was no way of getting things from Cuba to the States. There was one plane every day, Pan Am, and it wasn't very large. I don't think there were more than 200 on this. I mean, it wasn't a huge jumbo jet. I don't think those had existed yet. It was probably 120, 150 people, and you couldn't bring any luggage. I mean, you had hand luggage and that. Because I think they were probably contracted to take, you know, stuff out of Cuba. But anyway, people were told you could just bring your hand luggage and nothing more. And they even were children sitting on the laps of, you know, there'd be three and four children and they'd be on the laps of grown-ups. It was absolutely chock full and you had to wait your turn to get out. So, but Mary, at the Finca, they had a carpenter on the staff. Part of their staff was a carpenter. And Mary had him braid up all the paintings she wanted to bring, and her own china and silver, and then her own papers. And then there were all of Mary's papers. So there were several crates. And we went down, those were left at the Finca, and she and I went down every morning. We went down to the harbor. We went, we looked at the all the boats coming in, looking desperately for an American flag. And it was at least 3 weeks of doing, about 21 days of doing it, when we saw a small American flag and a Honduran flag on this little fishing. It was a, when I say little, it was maybe not quite twice the size of the Pilar. And it turned out to be a fishing boat that had refrigeration. They had lobster tails and shrimp and lobster tails coming up from Peru, or one of the countries, the South American countries, and the refrigeration had broken down, and the fish were going to be bad before it got to the States. So they were going to either offload it in the sea, or they thought maybe they'd be able to sell it to Cuba and just move on. And so Mary, you know, she went up to the captain, and he came off the boat on shore, and he spoke to her, and he was sort of shaking his head. Well, she motioned to me to stay behind, to stay away a bit, and he was shaking his head vehemently, no. And then she put her hand in her purse and pulled out a wad of something or other, some money, and then he told her to come on the boat, and when she came off the boat, she was sort of dancing. She caught me with the two of us danced around. She said, "Oh, they're going to do it," you know. We were just singing and dancing, and everyone else who was on the there on the wharf were saying, like, "Who are those crazy, you know, Americans? What are they up to?" But anyway, the next morning, he said 8 o'clock, and we got the stuff came down, the crates went on, and off they went. The boat went off, and it was only after that that Mary and I looked at each other, and I know we both had the same thought: "Oh my goodness, we have no piece of paper. We don't even we've no there's no insurance.
This is no way to insure something like this."
There was, you know, probably $1 million worth of paintings alone, but the various manuscripts were, you know, priceless. There was, you know, and this had gone off, and these people, they all she had said to them were just household goods were moving back to the States. She hadn't given any information of any kind. So it was weeks before we got to Tampa, because then we had to put our names down to get on the plane to go over. And it was really, we had some very dubious moments when we're saying, "Oh my God, what's going to happen? Will it be there? Will they say we don't know anything? We'd no idea what you're talking about. No such boat exists," and so on. But anyway, when we got there, sure enough, it was there, and we arranged for it all to be sent up, well, wherever it was going, but the papers went up to the office of Scribner's. And about 2 or 3 weeks or so into my working there, there was sort of that feeling, you know, that there's something live around. And it turned out that there were termites in the papers, so they had to go off and be fumigated. And poor Charlie Scribner was absolutely horrified, because, you know, he had priceless manuscripts in his files and his letters from all the authors, you know, Thomas Wolfe, all sorts of famous people, that Fitzgerald and so on, who he'd published. And then they had that bookstore on the ground floor that had one of the best, it was one of the best valuable books, you know, they had these wonderful old books and first editions and so on. So he was in terror till everything got out of there, and, you know, a fumigator came along to make sure that nothing had escaped from the office.
No one's looking for Cuban termites.
One excitement after another.
Now, somewhere also in this period, your last name changes.
It does. Well, that was almost just at the very end of things, at the end of my working for Mary, because over the years, well, Patrick, I didn't see. I met the three brothers, the three sons at the funeral, and Greg became a good friend, and we kept in touch. And he was married at that time when I first met him. And but he used to come down to, he lived in Florida, and then he got his medical degree, I think it was 64, 60, and then he was doing an internship or a residency up in Boston. And he was, I think, orthopedic surgery. And he used to come down to New York quite a bit. But what was on the mind of all three, well, especially Jack, who was in Idaho, and Greg, who was between Florida and Boston, was, our father left nothing to us in his will, but he did say, my wife Mary knows my intentions, and she will look after my children. You know, she knows what I intended. And so they had individually asked Mary, and, you know, to clarify this, and was there anything forthcoming for them? And Mary said, I think she referred them to Alfred Rice, but her lawyer. But she also said, well, you know, your father gave me no instruction, so I don't, you know, it's in the hands of the lawyer. He'll, you know, decide. So they asked Rice, and he said, well, we have no instructions. So, you know, if you have no instructions, you can't act. And so I know Greg, who always needed money, and Jack, pretty much always needed money. They both, but more Greg, you know, kept sort of urging me, well, can you take it up with Mary? Can you see? Is there any chance she's going to do anything? And that's how my friendship developed with Greg, because it became more urgent as years went by and nothing was happening. And anyway, in 1966, he was divorced that year, and he and I were married. And that went on, our marriage lasted 21 years,
I didn't know you were married 21 years to Gregory.
We were.
Much longer than I knew.
66 to 87.
And I'm going to leave the rest of the story of Gregory for those that want to read your book, Running with the Bulls. But I would like to know, personally, we know you're working on the Penn State letters. You do about 1,000 events a year. How do you find enjoyment and rest and peace these days? I know you still travel so much. You were just in Northern Michigan. What's a fun day for Valerie Hemingway these days?
Well, I have to say it's very stimulating having the letters. We work on them every Thursday from 8 till almost noon. And the first time before I wrote my book, I certainly kept away from it because I thought this is going to be very depressing. And because I hadn't really thought much about it during the years, I just put that behind me, the period with Hemingway. But actually, it was not, when I started writing that book, I found not only was it not very depressing, but it was very stimulating. When I learned, you know, when I looked back and saw how much I'd learned and how that had really formed my life in terms of my interests and how I went about when I read a book, you know, understanding it the way Ernest, you know, taught me that everything you do has to have meaning. You know, you gain from everything you do. And I think that has helped me along the way with, with some of the, not, I don't like to use the word boring stuff, but the stuff, the repetitive stuff that you do. He always had ways like every meal was an adventure and that. So doing the letters it's really interesting and it's fun because it's always fun if I can point out something that my two colleagues of a different generation and, you know, just different circumstances in their lives who are they're very fine students, researchers, and in Jerry's case, has written many books, you know, lively, lots of interest. But if there's one thing that I'm able to tell them that they wouldn't be able to know on their own, it just really makes my day. And that happens almost every single time we get together. Now we've been through everything once, and we're doing the footnotes. And now I'm learning from them because all of these things that I just took for granted. I mean, I never had that curiosity necessarily about if they're talking about some war, someone in a war, you know, some war hero that Ernest is, you know, mentioning. I mean, I've just said, okay, we'll say General MacArthur. Well, I know General MacArthur, but I don't know anything about him. But when you're doing a footnote, you have to distinguish that person in some way. So this is a whole new, you know, realm of learning for me. And so many, many things, like young Michael loves the sporting things. And Ernest is, I mean, every letter has some sporting event that he's seen or heard of or read about that Ernest mentions. And Michael avidly goes into Google or wherever you get it and finds out who this was, what he was doing precisely that year, that month that Ernest is referring to. And it's sort of, I mean, that was something that I, you know, when I was reading the letters or when he dictated them, I had no interest in what, who the sporting person was, or, you know, there might be Ernest that he lost or he won, and that was, you know, that was unusual. But I know, so now I see how other people, you know, how they expand their own knowledge, you know. And Jerry's a little older, so the things that he's interested in, the letters. So there's so many things when sometimes, you know, I was thinking, well, so many of those letters are very similar because on the same day he had the same, you know, the same things happen. He's reporting the way you do. If you wrote three letters on a day to three friends, you'd most likely, if you're telling about your own day, you'd be reporting the same thing, but they always find something new for me. So we both sort of feed each other on, you know, new knowledge to, you know, to us. So that makes it really interesting.
And speaking of new knowledge, I think usually the last thing I always ask you is to share something with us, that kind of debunks the whole persona, or that, you know, the Hemingway. Even he kind of perpetuated that hyper macho thing during the 40s and 50s, and then the stigma of the mental illness. I mean, he was an absolutely diligent writer. You said last time he was very structured. So I think that quote that always gets attributed to him, where they say, write drunk and edit sober. And so all these.
Oh, that definitely was not. That might have. I mean, I don't even think in his teens that might have been, but. Definitely. He's, you know, he told me how early on, you know, sometimes you're out with your friends, out with stimulating people like Pound and Fitzgerald and Joyce and so on. And you're having a few drinks and you go home and you're so stimulated, you sit down and write a bunch of stuff. And he said, invariably, the next morning, when he looked at it, he threw it all away. And he learned it's a waste of time ever. You know, if you're going to go out at night, just enjoy yourself. And if you're going to write, wait till the morning when you're sober, when your mind is at its optimum. And he wrote from when he woke up in the morning until he got to a good place. And it could be 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, probably never more than 4 hours, because that's about all the mind is going to, you know, work at an optimum, and even probably the last hour mightn't be so good. But he would always, the next morning, he would, because the last thing you write is usually the least good. So the next morning he always edited sober. He wrote sober and edited sober. And he did not, you know, even social events, he didn't mix. His work was his work. And that was done alone. And when that was put away, he didn't think about it the rest of the day. He just then enjoyed himself, because he felt the mind has to rest and the mind has to replenish itself. It has to, it needs that time away. And if you, the last thing he ever did, you know, he trained himself that if he was stuck in one bad place, that he never finished his day stuck in a bad place. He continued through, even if then what he wrote was nonsense, like as if he had been drinking, if it was just stupid. He kept writing until he loosened up, and then he stopped for the day. And when he stopped for the day, which was somewhere between 10 and 11 o'clock at the latest, he never thought about that till he looked at it the next morning, because he felt, You know, your mind is something that needs a rest. It needs replenishing.
I got to learn that lesson. I got to.
And it worked for him. Yeah. You know, I mean, he had, but it was because when I knew him, it was towards the end of his life, and he had all the wisdom of, you know, he might have had the wisdom of the practice and the learning of his trade. But if I'd met him 20, 40, you know, 60, well, not 60 years, 40 years, well, 40 years old, I don't, before when he was 20, I don't know what he would have told me. But you know, I think by 30, he had definitely settled into how he was going to be a professional writer and how he was going to do it. And he kept perfecting that method that he used. Now, that doesn't mean that other people could do that method and they're going to be a Hemingway. It just means that worked for him.
And then you referenced earlier too, and you've mentioned it before too, he had a zest for life. Every minute was important. Every meal, You told me one time he lived kind of like on nature's time. If it was raining, you put a rain jacket on. Doesn't mean you don't go outside. You embrace the day no matter what. So he tried to find joy on every moment throughout his life. Joy's,
from my point of view, he really learned how to live life as not determining what he was going to do, but waiting till the day arrived and what the optimum prospects for that day. I mean, of course, that a person who is sort of self-employed can do that. I mean, a lot of people have to get up and go to the office, whether it's raining or whether it's sunshining. But he did, for his life, it was where he could make the choices. He always matched his activities for the day to the type of day it was. And that was another thing that I found fascinating, because in many ways we do have certain choices in terms of, we may have to work at a certain time, but in our leisure time, we have choices, so that you don't decide, I'm going to go out on the lake today and it's like the most miserable day in the world. you could do something else that's equally pleasurable. But, we often get our minds set on, we're going to do this on that day, we're going to do this. But that wasn't him. He decided, how can the day best fit my the things I want to do, and I'm going to match them up. And that, again, as I say, that was because I grew up in a society that was very regimented, the people you did, you did what you were expected to do at the time you were expected to do it. And so this was a freedom. I mean, this was a true freedom that, I mean, we're always talking about freedoms today, about our freedoms and this and that. But he actually did choose, he waited for a good day for whatever the thing was that he wanted to do, and wasn't tied into that it's this day and this time.
Well, Valerie,
and I found that a wonderful way to live.
If we could all embrace that, it'd be great.
Yes.
Well, I wish you the rest of the day will continue in a great path for you. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us today. This has been priceless for me, and I really appreciate it. And I know how busy you are. And so I appreciate that. And it's only been a couple of weeks, but I already miss you. We need one more meal, quick.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. And I've really enjoyed this. I've had a lot of fun out of this myself.
Well, thanks again. And to the listeners out there also, we thank you. This is Christopher Struble. I've been your host today, inviting you to join us for more episodes of Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. And a special thank you to our special guest, Valerie Hemingway, author of Running with the Bulls. Check out that book.